Hello, everyone, and welcome to another exome-focused episode of the Ambry Next and Now podcast. My name is Christian Gund, and I'm one of the genetic counselors in the Clinical Genomics Department here at Ambry. One of the most unique aspects of our Exome Next test is our ability to evaluate for novel genetic etiologies. With a trio in hand and the tools we have available, we may propose the first documented case of mutations in a certain gene causing disease in humans. And today we're going to discuss two of the tools we use to make those calls. One is our CHAD database, and the other is our Embody system. So the first thing we're going to discuss is our CHAD database, which is our characterized and disease-causing gene database. We use the CHAD database to keep track of which diseases and symptoms have been associated with which genes. Here with us today, we have Erica Smith, one of our clinical genomics scientists who maintains the database to talk to us about CHAD. How are you today, Erica?
Hi, I'm great. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, of course. So first question, what is the CHAD database and what does it contain?
Well, the CHAD database, as you mentioned, is an Ambry resource that contains up-to-date evidence for the association between a gene causing a specific disease. The information in the database is integrated into our analysis software, so updates to the CHAD database help improve both computer-based and human-level analysis.
All right. And what's the difference between a characterized gene and one of the novel genes?
So there are an estimated 19,000 protein-coding genes in the human genome, but the function of all of these genes is not yet known. For only about 20% of the genome, or about 4,000 genes, there's a specific clinical phenotype or disease associated with mutations in that gene. We refer to these genes as characterized because we can use reports of previous patients with similar mutations to analyze new cases and guide a genetic diagnosis. The majority of genes, however, about 16,000, are not yet characterized, meaning we don't know what condition results when that gene is mutated. We call these genes novel, not because they're new to the human genome, but because we still need to figure out what they do. And I've been amazed by the pace of discovery in genetics. Currently, a few hundred novel genes are characterized each year. The first identifications of which genes underlie certain diseases occurred in the 1980s. Therefore, the fact that we already know the gene-disease associations for 4,000 genes is pretty amazing.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you mentioned the pace of discovery. Is that part of why it's important to maintain our own database? I mean, there are like public databases out there like HGMD and OMIM. Why is it so important that we maintain our own one?
Yeah, definitely. It's hard for any public database to keep up with the pace of discovery. The information in public databases such as HGMD and OMIM are important starting points for our database. We also integrate information from Ambry's previously reported patients and daily literature updates. This gives us an up-to-date list of possible diseases associated with each gene. But in order for the data to be truly useful in a diagnostic laboratory, we need to annotate the clinical validity of each gene-disease association. This involves critically assessing the evidence that mutations in a specific gene cause a specific reported disease. The clinical validity can help guide analysts in deciding whether new mutations found in patients are the likely cause of that patient's disease.
All right, so you're maintaining the database with the goal of, you know, making sure each idea that we have each of these diseases that are associating with each gene is clinically valid and has the right evidence backing it up. What's the actual process of that like? How do you go about maintaining the database?
So, in addition to updating the database with the most recent publications, it's really important to assess the clinical validity, as you said. To do this, we put a lot of care into reviewing publications, assessing the frequency of previously reported variants in healthy people, because the idea is that if we find previously reported variants in healthy people, it's probably not causing disease. And we also examine the actual patient symptoms from previous reports. So this whole process is not only important to Ambry, we're also collaborating with an international consortium to standardize clinical validity assessment called ClinGen. Developing standard guidelines for different companies, institutions, and researchers will help ensure that patients receive consistent diagnoses regardless of who processes their sample.
I mean, you mentioned obviously doing these literature searches and evaluating, you know, for clinical validity. What are the types of things you're looking for in a paper before you're willing to call something characterized based on it?
Well, broadly speaking, if we call a gene characterized, we should have some idea of what disease will result if a gene has a pathogenic mutation. But specifically, we've been delineating criteria drawn from our experience analyzing patient samples. So a characterized gene should have some combination of causing the same disease in at least two or three patients, plus some experimental evidence from animal models or cells that the gene has a function consistent with the disease. Characterizing a gene primarily requires gathering and interpreting the work of multiple research and clinical groups from all over the world.
Right. And I mean, you would obviously weight those sort of things on a paper-to-paper basis, like, you know, a paper from a group that specializes on that gene and suggests an association there is going to have much more weight than, say, like a genome-wide association study that has, you know, one of their patients is now associated with this disease sort of almost tangentially. And
you bring up a really good point. A lot of the screening papers will report association of one mutation in a patient out of a large cohort that has this disease. But we like to confirm that that patient actually has the symptoms of the disease, and we prefer to find papers where they've also excluded other possible explanations for that disease, like another mutation in a gene that's already characterized. So those are both important considerations.
Gotcha. So you've taken a look at a couple papers, this previously unknown gene. Now you have something that you're fairly certain is good association, a disease association with its gene. You're moving it from novel to characterized and putting this association in. Is there anything else that happens as that process goes forward, or is it just, you know, a big day for that gene? It's called characterized now.
I'm pretty excited about it. I get very stoked when I get to transfer a gene from novel to characterized. And sometimes the most exciting thing is when we have previously reported that a patient has this distinct set of symptoms and a candidate mutation in a novel gene. And then a paper will come out and say, oh, we have two more patients that have the exact same phenotype and a mutation in the same gene. And then we can actually go back and give the patient an amended report saying, well, previously this was just a candidate in a novel gene, but now that the gene is characterized, we can really be confident that this is the gene that's causing the disease. And you should also probably look out for these other associated symptoms that were observed in other patients. So it's really exciting to me to characterize a gene because it can really affect the clinical outcome of the patients tested.
Yeah, and definitely not to undercut the importance of just, you know, now having another gene where we know what mutations in them do from a medical standpoint is important, but definitely from our perspective, the ability to then see from all our past patients and check to see if this new information will be helpful to any of them is what's really great for us. All right, well, thank you for speaking with us today. We really appreciate you bringing your expertise on this subject to our podcast.
Thanks.
And hopefully we'll talk to you again another time, maybe.
Sounds great. Thanks.
So we use the CHAD database while we're evaluating cases to see if any of the alterations make sense in the context of the patient's symptoms. That can be relatively straightforward when we find a good match in a gene which has an established pattern of disease associated with it. Once we've ruled out those characterized genes, though, we move on to the novel genes. How does that work in practice, though? How do we look at a gene that has never had disease reported in humans before and decides it fits for this case? Well, today we've got Dipali Shinde here with us to discuss our process for evaluating these genes, which we call Embody. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Christian. Thank you.
So why don't you start with explaining to us what Embody stands for and give us a little summary of what it is.
So Embody is an acronym that we use, and it stands for Evaluation of the Molecular Basis of Disease. And as you briefly mentioned, it is the process by which we evaluate either a new disease association in a clinically novel gene for which no mutations have been definitively determined to cause human disease, or a completely novel genetic etiology or a disease association for a gene that has been previously characterized or for a different phenotype from what we have observed in our proband. since we do not have strong patient-based data to compare the clinical features of our proband, we look further into the molecular mechanism of gene function to find clues for its involvement in our proband's phenotype.
Okay, so we're not looking at evidence from a lot of patients. So what kind of evidence would we see that would give us confidence in the phenotypic overlap we're proposing, even if there wasn't much evidence from other patients in the literature?
So with the widespread use of whole exome sequencing and whole genome sequencing, a lot of cohort papers have been published where once in a while you would come across a patient who has been reported to have certain clinical features and maybe a variant in the gene that we are interested in looking at, but no further functional workup was done to definitively say that that was the causal variant. However, our strongest level of evidence does come from these one or two reported patients where likely pathogenic alterations have been reported as a result of these studies. And these patients might be one or two, and they might have some of the clinical features that overlap with our patient. And this is what we consider limited evidence based on Clinton criteria that we discussed before. And maybe as part of a large cohort, these can provide us with some level of evidence that we can look further into this gene. The second strongest level of evidence comes from the analysis of patients with overlapping clinical features who carry gross deletions or copy number variations that encompass the novel disease gene that we are interested in. And this is specifically the case if that gene has been found to be located in the critical region of a microdeletion syndrome and is thought to be responsible for majority of the clinical features seen in the proband, but no specific alterations within the gene itself have been implicated in the novel genetic etiology.
So, like, sometimes we might be seeing an actual mutation in a gene which had previously been spotted on a lot of microarrays or something like that.
That's correct.
And we can see, oh, it's been in this region over and over again. Our gene happens to fit in this region. And along with this other evidence, that might be our reasoning there.
That's correct.
Okay. So in those cases, we still have sort of proposed human cases of the disease related to that gene already, though. The implications there are a little more straightforward. How do we evaluate genes where there's just not even any of those kinds of examples?
So this is where we start looking deeper into the molecular mechanism, the function of the gene under normal circumstances, and then also look for model systems in which the effect of disrupting this particular gene function has been demonstrated. Ideally, we like to have results from in vivo animal model systems, such as mice, that carry mutations in the gene of our interest, especially if the mice recapitulate the phenotype that has been observed in our proband. Since these genes normally function in pathways, it is also important to look at the effect of disrupting the gene function on the target proteins. This can be achieved by studying gene function in vitro cellular model systems, where the effect of disrupting gene function on target proteins in the pathways can be very comprehensively evaluated. This is very helpful if mutations in the other genes of the same family or in the same pathway have been implicated in disease which has similar phenotype as what we see in our patient with mutations in the gene of interest. When available, we also like to look at the normal levels and patterns of gene expression, specifically whether it is expressed predominantly in the tissues or organs that are affected in our patient. In addition, clues to the developmental regulation of gene expression help us understand if the said gene might have been essential at the time of organogenesis during embryonic development.
Okay, so we're looking at model organisms, and we're looking at gene expression patterns, and we're looking for these things that do fit the pattern, but we're not just looking for positive evidence. What are the types of findings that might push us away from thinking that specific gene is right?
So all of these points that we just talked about can also be used to rule out a particular gene as a candidate for causing disease in our patient. For example, genes can have multiple transcripts encoding several different protein isoforms. And if the alteration that we have identified is found in an isoform that is not the major isoform or is not present in the affected tissues, chances are that the gene is not involved in the pathogenesis of disease in our patient. Secondly, additional clues can come from population databases that list alterations in genes that are tolerated in the general population. We do use the data from these databases very regularly to infer modes of inheritance as well as mutational mechanism for a particular gene.
And just thinking about what you said about having multiple transcripts and isoforms, I mean, I know looking, you know, that type of stuff can be noted in our chat database. You know, we'll see, okay, this specific disease has only been seen in, you know, mutations that affect this specific isoform, and that'll help us as the gene gets characterized going forward.
Right. And also, if there are loss of function mutations which have been reported in the general population databases such as the ESP and the EXAC, that can be a clue that perhaps the mutation or the alteration that we have observed in our proband might not lead to a loss of function. It might be something else. Could be a gain of function or could be dominant negative. And so you could get those kinds of clues as well from these population databases.
Interesting. Well, thanks for, you know, giving us all that information about EMBODY in general. But I do like to leave off with a more specific example. Could you give us an example of a case where we have found a promising phenotype in a gene that wasn't characterized before?
Definitely. So in the first 1,000 cases that were referred to AmbryGenetics for exome testing, we reported likely pathogenic variants in novel disease genes in approximately 7% of our cases, and about a third of those were subsequently corroborated by either functional workup in collaboration with research labs or by high-impact publications from other groups. One example that sticks out to me is that of DNM1, a gene that encodes the dynamin protein, and that plays a really critical role at neuronal synapses in the brain. Following exome sequencing and analysis in a 10-month-old patient with epilepsy, we identified a missense alteration in the DNM1 gene that was present in the patient but was absent in his unaffected parents and sibling. Since no patients with alterations in this gene had been reported in the literature at the time of analysis last year, we continued with the process of EMBODY to determine pathogenicity of the alteration in our proband. Consistent with its function and a localization in the brain, defects in this protein have been shown to cause epileptic seizures in mice. This was our strongest level of evidence in our proband until we came across a publication which had functionally characterized the alteration seen in our proband a few years earlier. The authors of this publication determined that this alteration causes a significant defect in the function of the dynamin protein, not only affecting the mutant molecules carrying the alteration itself, but also exerting a negative effect on the normal function of molecules that did not carry this mutation. Based on this level of evidence that we collected from model systems, as well as gene function and expression, we were able to report this alteration as a likely cause of epilepsy in our proband. What's interesting about this case is that within a week of sending the report to the physician, the Euroepinomics, the EPI4K Consortium, an international collaboration of physicians, scientists, and researchers from around the world, published their article on the significance of de novo alterations in DNM1 causing epilepsy by reporting 5 de novo mutations in pediatric patients with epileptic encephalopathy and other clinical features significantly overlapping with our proband. Such a confirmation of our EMBODY process gives us the confidence to continue analyzing and reporting alterations in novel disease genes, especially if they can be functionally tested following the report and can help the referring clinicians with the management of the patient's healthcare.
Right, and I liked how you started that off too by mentioning, you know, the results being further characterized through functional studies and further patients, you know. It really sort of drives home how exome is becoming, you know, part of the testing process. And it's not even looked at, you know, so much as this, you know, last final researchy type step where, you know, if this, you know, this will be the last thing we do and either it'll have an answer or it won't. You know, sometimes we are just part of pushing it forward even more. And, you know, we find this novel alteration and suggest, yes, you know, maybe this is worth further investigation. But it turns out that, you know, the physician isn't comfortable saying this is definitely a diagnosis we have until they do more functional studies. And that just, you know, makes better science for everyone when those results do end up getting published in the end.
That's very true. And then there are so many more resources on the web nowadays in order to connect different researchers or different clinicians who have patients where other labs have identified alterations in the same gene as their patient. And it's a way for them to get together and talk about their patients and come up with a plan for treatment or for further healthcare management of their patients.
Well, excellent. Thank you for talking about this with me, Dipali. I think, you know, it's definitely more clear why having an ability to evaluate these genes where disease hasn't been found in a really robust way, and a way that produces results is so important. So thank you for taking the time to sit with us, and I'll let you get back to that important work.
Thank you so much. Thank you for talking to me.
Thank you. So that is it for today. I hope you enjoyed that little tour of some of the resources we use in exome analysis. Chat and Embody are among the many tools we use to try to find an answer for our clients. You can see how they work together, though. CHAD helps us keep track of which genes we already know disease patterns for and how confident we should be in those associations, while Embody gives us the means to pick up and continue evaluating based on other literature once those options have been exhausted. Of course, these tools are not finalized. Genetics changes fast, and here at Ambry, we're always iterating and making improvements to our current techniques and tools, as well as developing new ones, because we want to offer our clients the best testing possible. I hope you enjoyed our conversations today and have a better understanding of how we put together our exomes. If you'd like more information on any of our tests, please do check out our website at www.ambrygen.com, and I'll see you next time.